Hello, how are we?
Really good. How are you?
Okay. Is the sun shining?
It's all right. It's all right. It's not brilliant. What about where you are?
Sorry, it's glorious. It's endlessly glorious. I mean, I spend most of my mornings and evenings in a studio, so I don't really know what's going on anywhere, to be honest.
At least we have windows in our studio. You probably don't.
I actually, do you know what? I kind of work in a place where there are windows in a big old church, and it's a bit of a lie. I do see the seasons pass by, and I, you know, sit there wondering how many more of them do I have left.
Dark.
It's a nice bright start to the morning, isn't it?
Well, I hope we have a fair few more left, David.
Well, I hope so, but you never know. I'm making the most of it.
Well exactly. Let's talk, first of all, David, let's talk about Independence Day, because you've got Independence Day Live happening at the Royal Albert Hall.
Which is in London. Fair way to come.
It's worth it. Definitely worth it. I mean, I've not seen any of the, when they've done sort of like these their big blockbusters with a big Philharmonic before, but I would imagine something like Independence Day would just be perfect for this.
Well, it's an event movie, and you know the Albert Hall is an event venue, and the screen that they put up is so enormous. It's like one of the biggest things I've ever seen. And the great thing about it is not just the fact that it's a live orchestra playing it, which is hugely exciting in itself, because you know there is a certain energy that comes from watching brilliant musicians play brilliantly. Mm. But it's kind of like the communal experience of being in a room with, you know, sort of 4,000 or 5,000 people all watching the same film at the same time, experiencing the same thing and going on the journey at the same time as a sort of communal societal experience. It's quite rare now. To have that kind of thing, and I think what I think orchestras are quite keen on it, because it's a way of getting audiences in to see live players which might not otherwise do it, because obviously, you know, classical music is something which is kind of having diminishing returns as far as audience and sales are concerned. And I suppose, as you know, years go by and people who traditionally would listen to classical music because their parents do, you know, we get into now generations of people whose parents don't listen to classical music, then the opportunity to see, you know, sort of classical work sort of diminishes as people sort of demand more and more sort of other things. But what I'm hoping is perhaps that the, you know, these sort of live film experiences with a big symphonic orchestra might get people interested enough to come back and watch, you know, they might watch Mendelssohn, or they might watch some Debussy or Dvorak or Shostakovich or Tchaikovsky or Beethoven, you know, especially if, you know, in the doing of these things, we, you know, we talk about the influences and talk about the power of an orchestra. But ultimately, those are icing on the cake things. You know, the big thing about it is that you get to watch this, you know, completely over the top film with an over the top score played in front of your face by one of the greatest orchestras in the world.
But it does sound absolutely spectacular, and you're right. I suppose you look at movie soundtracks, and invariably, if a movie's got an orchestral soundtrack, it's a good entry level for young adults to sort of like start appreciating more classical music.
Yeah, I mean, I think the film music has become a genre within itself anyway, and it you know, people consider, because you use an orchestra, people think that it's a classical, but it isn't really. I mean, classical music has many different forms. Film music is exists for a reason other than purely for the music. Film music exists to support and be a part of the film experience, and in its way, it's not really any more important than the editing or the script or the performances. You know, it's a team sport. I mean, for, you know, classical music is written with the idea that music is the end, is the end result. That's really what it's all about. It's the exploration of wherever we get to with that piece. But with film, the music exists because something in front of me is happening and it needs musical support. So, you know, its prime reason to exist is to support the movie. But the good thing is that, you know, when it works really well, and we all know which ones work really well, they kind of have a life outside of the film, and so, you know, then you become actually aware that, you know, film music has now produced kind of concert standards. You know, people will play Star Wars, or, you know, it goes anything from, you know, like Pink Panther, Singing in the Rain, Goldfinger, you know, Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Taxi Driver. You know, there's so many different sorts of music that have become popular through film. And I think people like reliving the experience, and when it does make the leap, you know, from the movie theater to your, you know, perhaps to your hi-fi or to your you know, MP3 player or vinyl, whatever it is, you know, it's there's something quite joyous about it, because you know that it's kind of working on a different level. But that's not the reason why it's written. It's written to support the movie.
David, what's your process? Do you have to go in straight, or do you have a time to reflect, or what do you do?
Here's my preference. My preference is I get delivered a finished film that's going to have no more changes to it, and the director says, do what you want. Here's the reality. Most of the time, you will get a first cut. You will get an assembly of a film. So something that might end up being 95, 100 minutes long, might be 2 hours long by the time, you know, but when I get it first. And you will have a series of notes and discussions and conversations with directors and producers about what they want out of it, you know, the sort of things that they want to feel. Then you kind of have to start, you lock yourself away with it and try and come up with the answers to the problems that the film presents you with. It kind of begs you to solve the kind of emotional or storytelling problems that the film might have, and you have to sort of respond to that. And it's a very peculiar process. It's a bit like an actor like researching his character. You sort of have to get into it, you know, you have to sort of immerse yourself in it. And then start to try and make the feelings that you're having in music form, and it's a process that I can't really successfully explain to you any more than a novelist could explain why they decide to write a book, or, you know, when what happens in that book. Sometimes it just leads you, but I think it's not for no good reason that most of what I do is based on something that I'm seeing. Certainly if I see something and I respond to it, that's the key. You know, I don't really write much music that isn't in response to something else. You know, I haven't written a piece of concert music, for instance, where I sat down and go, like, I would like to explore this, that, or the other. You know, it's like if someone says, do you want to do a movie? And I look at the movie and I go, like, oh my God, I love that. And I can hear it in my head, and that's when you start working.
What's harder? Is it harder to score for a big Hollywood blockbuster like Independence Day or James Bond, or is it easier to score for TV, or are they both exactly the same for you?
I think they're exactly the same. What difference there is in expectation. Because if you think about it, I mean, I'm sitting in a studio in front of a couple of monitors with a film on it, with a keyboard, and this film passes in front of my eyes, and I know that I've got to write music for this next sequence, which is 2.5 minutes long, for instance. Now, if that's a TV thing or animation or a huge Hollywood blockbuster, the job's still the same. I still have to write that music, and that music has to work with what's in front of me. What happens is expectation and interference. So certainly, you know, the more money that gets spent, the more people will have an opinion on what you're doing. So that's, you know, that becomes sort of 80% of the job. I think, you know, to a certain extent, writing the music is very often the easiest part of the job, and the most difficult part is actually the sort of dealing and coping with the personalities involved, and making sure that everyone goes away smiling, because everyone's going to have a different idea about what works and what doesn't work. So it's very much a sort of juggling of sort of people politics. And but, you know, generally I've been very lucky that the people that I've worked with have been fantastic, and they've shone lights on things that I hadn't really thought about, and I think we've sort of equally enlightened each other about the possibilities of what you could do with film and music. So I mean, I've been very fortunate But you know, it's not always like that. You know, there's plenty of horror stories of, you know, test audiences deciding that they don't like something, or studio executives deciding that, you know, someone's just had a hit with something else, so we better make it like that. You know, there's always those kinds of apocryphal stories, but ultimately you just have to do what you think is best for the film, and keep your fingers crossed that the other people who are paying for it agree.
Yeah. When you look back on your career so far, and you've done some unbelievably cool things, David, is the James Bond work still the coolest?
Well, what are we calling cool? Yeah, some people think mirrored sunglasses are cool, don't they? it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, in terms of how well-known things are, probably on a worldwide thing, James Bond is probably one of the biggest things you could ever hope to do. But in terms of being cool, it's funny, but the stuff that I do for TV appears to be considered a bit cooler. I mean, it's mainly because it's like really, really young people. When I did Little Britain, when we started doing Little Britain, and that became such a huge kind of comedy event, on British TV, and all kids in, you know, playgrounds were using the catchphrases, that became the coolest thing. And now I think probably it's Sherlock, you know, Sherlock, which has become...
Cat has just had a little fangirl moment there when you said just saying the word.
Well, it's odd, isn't it? Because, you know, I mean, Sherlock, now, you know, Martin and Benedict are like rock stars. it's unbelievable, the reception that they get and the fanaticism that they create. I mean, the show is, I think, incredibly well constructed and conceived and written and put together by everyone, and it's just one of those very sort of special things that doesn't happen all that often. But to get Martin and Benedict, you know, to do it continually is a great coup, I think. But it's a brilliant piece of casting, based on I think brilliant writing and production value. So good, you know, good on British TV, I think, you know, and won another Emmy on Sunday night.
Yes, for it. Yeah, great, won an Emmy.
That's terrific.
It's superb. But David, you know, we're probably taking too much of your time already. We won't take any more of your time. Is that what you're working on right at this moment, the new Sherlock? Is there anything you can tell us?
I am on the new Sherlock right as we speak. I'm actually in the studio. I am just getting to the end of the first episode of the next series. Yeah, we've got three altogether.
Okay.
And it's I think you will not be disappointed.
What happens?
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happens. No, I can't say. it's very difficult because you end up doing things where you've worked on it or you've been on set and things have happened and you want to talk about it. You want to say, oh God, we just did this thing with Benedict yesterday and it's da da da. You want to, and then you think, no, you can't, because I mean, the great joy of it, I think, other than watching it unfold without you knowing what's going on, is that there are surprises, and you find yourself sitting there and your jaw will drop and you go like, oh my god. And there are moments in this season where that happens, and I was just going like, oh my god. So it's hugely exciting, and I think I'm not speaking out of turn. I think it's probably the best group of three scripts we've had. I have very high hopes. But Michael Price and I, who do the music, you know, we always say we just do our best to not to mess it up, because they have delivered some fantastic episodes, and
yeah.
I'm hugely excited about people seeing it.
Well, you got us excited already. And Independence Day Live, of course, at Royal Albert Hall on Thursday. So if you are in Yorkshire and you've got a car or a train ticket, get yourself down there. It's got to be well worth it.
Or just get a helicopter.
Yeah. That's about that. I've got one of those in the backyard.
Yeah, so there you can get a helicopter. There are flights. There's so many
ways. It's easy. David Arnold, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Yorkshire.